Hopkins. Bryant for the win.
Interviews from your favorite local coaches and athletes.
He's getting to the basket of will, and he's hitting that three-point shot with some consistency now, and he's just in a groove right now where he's pretty well unstoppable.
Hall of Fame and legendary guests.
I was driven by loving to play, liking the challenge of being an NFL quarterback, but after 18 years, I was 1 month short of 39 years old. It's time to go.
Analysis and insight on the latest national sports topics. Live, it's Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
Welcome back to a brand new edition of Drive Time Sports. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini, alongside Travis Anderson, and there is plenty to get into once again today. We are going to talk a lot on the national front. Still a little silent as far as the local sports is concerned, although we will return for a basketball game tonight as Emory travels on the road to take on Manti. We talked to Coach Jeff Cincinnatus about that yesterday. So if you missed it, we'll play a few clips from that interview for you. But today we will focus heavily on the college football playoff. And there's a great college football game tonight in Florida and Oklahoma, one of the few non-playoff bowl games that I'm actually excited about. 6 p.m. start time for that contest.
You're listening to Drive Time Sports on KOAL AM 750. The play-by-play home of the Emory Spartans.
We're less than 48 hours away from the college football playoff. We're down to the final four teams, and ultimately, I know we got some New Year's Day 6 bowls, but it just doesn't really spark my interest as much this year. I don't know what it is. I am, however, ready for the Final Four, and I do believe we have two games that are pretty clear-cut and dry, and at least who I'm picking, and we'll get into that in just a few moments. Nonetheless, it makes for some really fascinating matchups in Alabama and Notre Dame. I mean, a lot of name recognition. Same thing could be said for Clemson and Ohio State. Will the games live up to the marketing? We're going to talk about that more right now with our next guest, Antoine Staley of Athlon Sports, kind enough to join us throughout the entire year to talk college football. And now, less than 2 days away from the playoffs, he's joining us once again. Antoine, a pleasure as always. Thank you.
It's good to be with you again.
You and I had a conversation off the cuff, and this is, I guess, a great way to start this particular segment. We agree the rightful four teams are in the playoffs, so we can throw that, push that conversation aside. We agree. Top four teams are in the playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Notre Dame earned their way throughout the regular season. I know a lot of people thought that the way they played against Clemson in the ACC championship was they shouldn't have been there, but I thought just you can't discount what happened the first 10 or 11 weeks in the season. Because if you do that, then what's the whole point? That's kind of the way I view it. Like, what's the point of playing all those games in the first place? It's a resume. And then they built their resume. It didn't end the way they wanted to, but they still built their resume. And I think their resume was better than Texas A&M because they actually played in the conference game and A&M didn't.
Sure, correct. And Notre Dame did beat the number one team in the country. And I know Trevor Lawrence didn't play, but the fact of the matter is they did beat the number one team in the country. Let's start by talking Notre Dame and Alabama. Right now, I believe the spread is 17.5, if I'm not mistaken. I do believe Notre Dame can keep this game within two scores, but ultimately I will pick Alabama to win this contest. Too much talent on this team, on this Bama team offensively. But I will say this. The reason I think Notre Dame can stay within three scores is because this is a Notre Dame offense that loves to take chunks of change off the clock. If they convert third downs like they have through the majority of the season, they'll keep that Alabama offense off the field. And that's how you can keep it close. I don't believe Notre Dame can win a shootout with Alabama. Notre Dame has to control the clock. They have to limit the possessions that Alabama has. And if they do that, I think we could have a competitive game here.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what it boils down to. Can they run the ball effectively? Can they avoid turnovers, unlike what happened in the Clemson game? Can they convert when they have the opportunities to? And, yeah, I think we talked about it off air that we just didn't feel like they did that against Clemson. They had their opportunities to stay in the game, but they didn't convert on the opportunities early. And then once you do that against a team like Clemson or Alabama in this case, then, yeah, you're going to lose. And you're going to lose handily. It's kind of like a snowball effect. Yeah, everything, one bad thing happens, and then it goes to two, and then it goes, and then all of a sudden, you just, it's just like this huge, gigantic thing that you can't overcome. So, yeah, I think it's important for them to be able to take care of the football, be able to run the ball effectively, sort of what they did against Clemson the first time. And then, like you said, just kind of do some play action pass, because this isn't a great Alabama defense. They're good, but yes, a team like Florida showed in the SEC Championship, you are able to move the ball against them. So I definitely think that's kind of what they're going to have to do, is just, like you said, play time control and be able to run the ball effectively. If they can do that and try to limit Alabama's possessions, then, yeah, I think they have a chance. I still like Alabama by double digits. I don't know if it's going to be by 17, but I do think Alabama is definitely the better team here in this matchup.
Yeah, I think the main problem, it's on the outside. I know Najee Harris is great. Notre Dame, they did struggle to contain the run against Clemson. I mean, Travis Etienne was good, and that was another element of surprise for me in the ACC title game, because Etienne, even going back to the playoff victory over Notre Dame, had not had a lot of success against Clark Lea and that rushing defense. Now you take a look at what Notre Dame has in Najee Harris, and I believe Harris will have an effective game, but for me it's Devontae Smith on the outside. I mean, this is the most explosive player in college football, and that's where Alabama is going to hold an edge. I just don't believe Notre Dame's secondary can contain what Bama has outside.
Yeah, it's this Alabama team, and granted, like they had injury, they could be even better than what they are. So it's like a creative team in NCAA football back in the day, where you just recruit so well that it just embarrassment among riches. I mean, that's how great their offense is. Okay, you try to take away their run, they got effective receivers in the passing game. You try to take that away, then they can run the ball effectively, and they have a solid quarterback in Matt Jones. It's like trying to pick your poison. I don't know how you can stop this. I don't know how anybody really stops this team, to be completely honest with you. They're just that deep. They're able to run the football. They're able to pass the ball effectively. And they have a solid offensive line, too. They really, at least on paper, they have no weaknesses offensively anyway. So, yeah, I think that's where it's really going to be challenging for Notre Dame. I know, like I say, Clemson played them really well, and I thought they were able to hold their own, but at times, at least in the first quarter. But, yeah, this team is just so strong, and it's going to be like no other offense I think they've seen all year.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, Notre Dame's best defense is going to be their offense. You're going to have to rely on Kyren Williams. He broke the 100-yard mark, I think, six times this season. Notre Dame's got a very experienced offensive line. I know Coach Nick Saban talked about that earlier this week. That's where Notre Dame is going to have a chance to win this game. And I don't think it's really a coincidence, Antoine. If you go back to the Notre Dame victory over Clemson, Kyren Williams scored, I believe it was the second play from scrimmage, if memory serves me right. I mean, he was fantastic in that game, went for a 140 and three scores. That's Notre Dame's only chance in this game. I mean, we could talk about Ian Book. I know it's a kid with a lot of experience. He played with a lot of confidence at points and times in this season. Notre Dame's not going to slow Mac Jones. The only way to keep this game close is for Kyren Williams to have a big game. I think that's the only path to victory.
Yeah, that's what I said. Like, it's kind of the same formula they lose to beat Clemson the first time when they ran for 200 yards. Yeah, I think that's their formula, is the success, to try to maintain an advantage in this game. Without that, if they're not able to run the football, then, yeah, I think it's going to be a really, really ugly pretty quickly. They have to, because I think Alabama wants Ian Book to sit back there and throw the football. I think that falls right into their hands, exactly what they kind of want him to do.
Final score in this game, what are you rolling with?
I'm going to 52-34.
Ooh, high scoring game. You know what? I'm going to go a little lower, just because Notre Dame's going to have to try to control the clock. I'm going to say 38-24, Bama.
Okay.
I think Notre Dame's got to limit their possessions. I just don't know that Notre Dame has the capability of doing this in the secondary. Let's move on. We'll top Clemson, Ohio State, and I honestly believe that this game is going to have a bigger deficit, a bigger margin of victory than the Notre Dame-Bama game. I just don't see, based off what we've gotten to witness already, Ohio State's offense being limited by Northwestern, being limited at times by Indiana. You look across the board, there is NFL talent all over when we talk about this Clemson defense. I just don't think it's a good matchup for Ohio State. And I know right now the spread is 6.5, I think, by Clemson. I think Clemson covers this, and they cover it easily.
Yeah, I think what's going to hurt them is Ohio State, kind of the status of players are kind of unknown with Chris Olivier and also Baron Browning, two starting guys, the top receiver and the top linebacker. are kind of unknown because of the protocol situations with COVID. Without them, I definitely think it's going to be a challenge. I think even with them, it's going to be a challenge to try to slow down Clemson, whether offensively or defensively there. You saw Northwestern was able to put a good game plan there for 2.5 quarters or so to limit them defensively. I know Northwestern has a great defense, and they couldn't score worth a lick, but this is definitely a different Clemson, different Clemson team that that's a different animal, especially on the offensive side of the ball with Trevor Lawrence and Travis Etienne, and you can't make mistakes against them. It's not the same mistakes you made against Northwestern. So I definitely think you're going to get a really, really good effort for Ohio State, but it's kind of hard for me to go against Clemson just because I think when it's all said and done, they are the better team from top to bottom. But it wouldn't surprise me if Ohio State were to keep this close there because I think they're talented too, and I think the time off might have helped them too as well to prepare a game plan for a Clemson team, which they actually know pretty well they played last year in the playoffs. So I don't think it's really any secrets between any of these teams.
Yeah, just looking at what Justin Fields has done this year when he's gone up against a stout defense. I mean, for instance, we can look at the win over Indiana. Okay, so they win 42-35, and he wasn't great in that game. I mean, he had 3 interceptions, if I remember correctly. And then you go to the Northwestern game, 12 of 27 for 114 yards and 2 more picks. I mean, he's been prone to turning the football over. And when you look at this Clemson defense, even though they have a couple of true freshmen starting on this defense, I mean, it's so talented front to back. It's unlike anything he has seen. And so I'm just using the sample size in the Northwestern Indiana game to say, okay, I think Fields will struggle in this contest.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like you said, I think they're young in some areas. Talk about Clemson's defense. But, yeah, this is – I don't think the Big Ten had any talented defenses like this throughout the whole year. No, Northwestern is great, but I think they're reason their defense plays so well is because they're well coached, not necessarily because they have a ton of talent on there. Although I won't discount all the talent that they have. They have really talented secondary, but I think from top to bottom, this is definitely as good of a defense he's going to face. That's what I think Clemson's defense is great. They've shown the ability to be able to move the ball against them. We've seen that against some teams there, Notre Dame, some other spots this year. But, yeah, I think when you talk about it, it's all said and done. I think Clemson is going to find ways to try to get him out of his rhythm. And if you don't have your top receiver potentially, I definitely think that's going to be even more of a detriment to their offense.
And I think we have to talk about this as well. And, I mean, it's odd to talk about special teams, at least in this avenue, when you're talking about a playoff game. But Drew Crispin for Ohio State averages close to 50 yards per punt. And that's a factor in playoff games. Field position is that big. And I think when you have a punter of this status and you don't know if he's going to play or not, that plays a factor in a game too, especially when you're the underdog.
Yeah, everything does. Like any kind of special teams, whether you talk about field goal and punting, try to punt a team back and pin them in the shadow of their own end zone. And like you say, just talk about field position, because if a closing team goes 3-and-out, let's say, Ohio State is able to pin Clemson back and they go 3-and-out, you get the ball back near midfield. I mean, that makes all of the world a difference. You're playing with a short field with maybe 50, 40 yards to go as opposed to 60, 70. And yeah, I mean, in a game like this, especially how close it could potentially be, yeah, I think it's a huge difference in the way, and it's also a huge difference the way you call plays too as well. So yeah, it doesn't really get talked about enough on special teams, but it's a big deal. And that's why you see these coaches going out recruiting the top punters and the top kickers, because every little bit helps, especially in close games like this.
Antoine, final score, Clemson, Ohio State, what do you got?
I'm going to go with Clemson 41, Ohio State 27.
Oh, okay. All right. I like the 41 score. I was thinking anywhere between 38 and 41. I see Lawrence throw for 4 scores in this game. I just don't think Ohio State musters up enough offense. I'm going to go 38-16. I'll take Clemson 38-16. I just don't see Ohio State effectively moving the football and putting points on the board. And then I think we get to a point where it becomes desperation, and that's what we saw in the ACC title game for Notre Dame. And when you become desperate against Clemson, well, that's when the spread continues to grow.
Yeah, you like the Clemson defense more than I do. I do too, but I just don't. I think it's maybe, just kind of the year that we've had. I don't think we necessarily have that really shut down defense like we've had in years past. And like I said, I think a part of that is because of COVID and the lack of practices and things like that that we've had. And it's just been a real wacky year, and tackling hasn't been great, and a lot of things haven't been great on the defensive side of the ball there too. But yeah, I definitely think Ohio State can. I think they can get past 20. Will they or not, I don't know. But I definitely think they can. They're good enough where they can score over 20 points. I don't think they're going to be Clemson, but I definitely think they're talented enough where they could do that.
Yeah, and I want to piggyback off of what you just said a moment ago. You mentioned COVID and all the weird, wacky things we have seen this year. There's so much talk about Ohio State being at an advantage for only playing six games. And I buy that argument. I do. I buy what Dabo was saying and why he placed Ohio State out of his top 10. That's fine. However, when you look at the other three teams in the playoffs, Notre Dame, Clemson, Alabama, they all delivered stinkers at some point in time where they managed to come out on top. I mean, Clemson put together a rather shoddy performance against Boston College. They were lucky to come out of that game with a win. Notre Dame put up a shoddy performance against Louisville. They were lucky to come out of that game. When you look at the defensive numbers for Alabama at several times this year, be it Ole Miss, be it Texas A&M at times, they were very vulnerable. They had opportunities to work those kinks out. Only playing six games, you really don't have a lot of opportunity because you can't simulate a game in practice. And so while many are viewing this as an advantage for Ohio State in a playoff scenario, I think it's a disadvantage.
Yeah, I think anytime you're able to play more games and get to know your team and personnel, that's always an advantage to me. I don't think playing less games, I mean, unless you're talking about injuries, I think that's probably the only thing there, and the little nicks and pains that you may have as opposed to playing 12 games. I don't think it's an advantage at all because, yeah, I mean, you still don't – you really don't know what a team is after half of the season. That's essentially what they played. They played half of a year. So, I mean, could they be better than what they are? Yeah, I think they certainly could be. I think a lot of people – projected them to be here at this point, which is why they were right in the top four or five before they even played the game. But also, I mean, going through that adversity and going through those ups and downs, and yeah, I think that it's really beneficial to every single team, and I think you have to during the course of the season, because that's the only way you get to know your team and what you truly have. If you don't have that, and you don't play to have that experience of playing all those games, then you know, it's hard, like you said, it's hard to simulate that throughout the course of a practice. You just can't. It's not realistic.
Again, Antoine Staley, our guest of Athlon Sports, talking college football. Antoine, I always enjoy the conversations. I know, just like myself, you're looking forward to Friday. We should have plenty to talk about next week as we gear up for the national championship, whoever it may be. I appreciate the time. And, of course, before I let you go, let the listeners know where they can find some of your college football previews that I'm sure you're handing out right now.
Yeah, you find me at Athlon Sports there. Also find me at Twitter, Antoine Staley, where we're just kind of breaking down the bowl games there and we also looked at the Florida-Oklahoma game today, which is going to be tonight, which is it's definitely a lot of opt-outs for Florida, so they're definitely going to have their hands full with that one.
Antoine, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you again for the time.
Yeah, no problem.
Let's pause for just a moment. We'll come back. We'll transition out of football. Let's talk baseball. San Diego Padres have definitely stolen the headlines over the last couple of days. What does that mean? And we'll also take a look at some of the big names still on the free agent market, including Trevor Bauer and DJ LeMahieu. That's coming up when we return right here on Drive Time Sports.
Pitch to Bellinger. He swings and he hits a high fly ball right center field. This ball's gone!
Now a 3-1 for Acuna. Swinging a high fly ball! Deep to left field! Way, way back! It's gone!
Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. Feeling like a bullet, jumping
out a gun. I'm feeling like a winner. It's been a busy week if you're a San Diego Padre fan. A lot of stuff happening in Southern California. Obviously, these are moves to at least compete with the defending World Series champion Los Angeles Dodgers. Have the Padres done enough? Well, they've certainly stiffened up that rotation. We know what it will look like in 2021, and it could be even better come 2022. We'll talk Padres. We'll talk about some of the other moves around Major League Baseball. It seems like another rebuilding phase for the Tampa Bay Rays, and what is happening in Chicago. Joining us right now to talk about that and more, we have Steve Bortstein. He joins us to talk Major League Baseball frequently, and now as we hit the hot stove, winter time, boy, it's a great time to talk baseball. Steve, thank you for the time again today.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you, and Happy New Year to you and your family.
Hey, you as well. Thank you very much, Steve. Great place to start. It's by talking about the San Diego Padres. They definitely have made some moves. They bring in 2018 Cy Young winner Blake Snell. He was fresh off a brilliant performance in the World Series, which Kevin Cash brought to a close after one hit to, well, two hits for the game, but one hit to Austin Barnes. Then they turn around and they pull a move for Yu Darvish, who was the runner-up this last year in the NL Cy Young race behind only Trevor Bauer. When you look at what the Padres managed to accomplish, yes, it is exciting because they brought in two legitimate pitchers, and they really only gave up Zach Davies. They managed to hang on to their top prospect in Mackenzie Gore, and if you're a Padre fan, that has to make you smile. Another thing that has to make you smile is this team has been a doormat in the NL West over the last decade or so, and now they're at least attempting to make moves. Spent a lot of money on Manny Machado. They have one of the most entertaining players in baseball in Fernando Tatis. And now they add a solid pitching rotation. I still don't think they're better than the Dodgers, but I will put them in the top three along with Atlanta.
And I agree with that. But I just want to, you know, I want to be the negative voice in the room here. Because how do you sell this to Padres fans? Okay, yeah, we want to compete with the Dodgers. That's our goal. We want to compete with the Dodgers. We want to be better than the Dodgers, right? Because the Dodgers are world champions. They're in our division. Okay, so who are we going to go get? We're going to go get the guy who held the Dodgers to two hits and six innings in Game 6 of the World Series before they pulled him. A World Series that we weren't even remotely close to being good enough to be in the first place because we didn't have all these other parts around us. Oh, okay. Well, that's not good enough. Okay, well, we're going to go get Yu Darvish. The last time Dodgers fans saw Yu Darvish in a game of any importance, he was vomiting all over himself in the World Series a couple of years ago. Now, are they good pitchers? Absolutely. Oh, and by the way, just in case, we might not know really whether or not Clevinger or LeMay are any good based on, you know, Clevinger's injury, which is going to keep him out in 2021. And we don't know if LeMay is going to come back any good at all. The rotation might be great, but it also might be garbage in 2021. So we're just really gambling here. So for before Padres fans decide they're just going to put all their eggs in the basket here, remember, you don't have Clevinger in 21. You might not get the best LeMay in 21, and now you're gambling on Blake Snell, who probably threw a fit when he was pulled from the World Series in Game 6, legitimately so. And we'll get to the Rays and that firestorm that's going to start up over there. And we don't know about Darvish. We don't know if Darvish is going to be any good when he starts getting back around the old familiar confines of Dodger Stadium, where the last time Dodgers fans saw him, he was basically useless. So I just don't buy that this is the greatest move ever. I agree with you wholeheartedly that not having to give up key prospects, that's a good thing for the Dodgers. That's a good thing for the Padres because they get to keep, you know, some young talented players in their roster. And I think 21 is the year of, oh, we don't know yet. And 22 is the year really the Padres, I think, are going to be the danger team in the National League West and probably the entire National League.
I agree with that 100%. And I think that Padre fans need to remember this. It's exciting this year, but there are levels that you must climb to get to the top. And when you look at what they will get back in 2022, every one of these moves signifies that they see somewhat of a little gap, somewhat of a little space where they can pull ahead as far as the Dodgers and the Braves, because that is the cream of the crop in the National League. Now, as far as the Yu Darvish trade goes, I think San Diego wins this deal hands down. I think when you look at the Snell deal, there's several layers to that onion that you got to peel off. But when you look at the San Diego-Chicago Cub deal, there's no doubt in my mind San Diego wins this deal because it was simply a cash dump for the Cubs. And we'll talk about the Cubs in just a moment. They signed Darvish to a six-year, $126 million deal. Since 2019 at the All-Star break, he's got a 2.4 ERA, a 5.4 WAR. Those are important numbers. This was an obvious salary dump for the Cubs, who no longer have Theo Epstein. And anytime you have a salary dump, some team comes out on top. Whoever worked out a deal with the Cubs were going to come out on top. I don't really pay attention to dollars much in baseball. You want to pay the luxury tax, by all means, go right ahead. It's not a hard cap like in the NFL. So I try to stray away from those numbers. But the bottom line is, the Cubs wanted to dump this salary that they gave Darvish. So the Padres, in my mind, are the obvious winners.
No question. As far as the Snell deal is concerned, look, the Rays are an interesting story because I think there's a lot happening within that organization right now. Look, Cash took a ton of heat for the move in Game 6. Then you had the little Arozarena story that came up after the World Series was over. They're going to have the World Series, post-World Series meltdown of any team we've seen the last 10 years. This is going to be a Marlins-esque fall from grace, I think, for the Tampa Bay Rays, just because they were riding a wave of success, and then it all came crashing down in the matter of just one pitching change in the sixth inning of Game 6 of the World Series. So I think they're going to fall. I think they're going to fall badly in this next season, especially when you look at, okay, a healthy New York Yankees in that division, if they can stay healthy for a presumed 162-game season. The Red Sox are starting to make some moves as well, so you know they're not going to be, you know, in the dumps for too long. They may not be great in 21, but you know they're making moves. As far as the Padres deal is concerned, absolutely, it's a win-win on the Darvish deal. I think for the Snell deal, is more, look, we made a mistake in the World Series. We have a clubhouse in disarray, and we're going to fall apart. That was definitely a win for the Padres.
Again, Steve Bortstein, our guest right now, as we talk Major League Baseball and some of the moves that have come through over the last three or so days. We'll talk about the Cubs for a moment, because again, and you have to link these two trades together. No more Theo Epstein. Jed Hoyer now makes his first trade as general manager of the Chicago Cubs. And I think we need to go back to what Tom Ricketts said. Quote, "I don't think anybody's tearing anything down." Well, I don't really know what he's talking about, because this is absolutely a teardown trade. Okay, the bottom line is the Cubs receive Zach Davies, and you and I have got to watch Zach Davies a lot, right, in the NL West. I think he's a fine pitcher. In fact, he may be number two in that rotation. The NL Central is not good, so I think just looking at the roster the Cubs had, it could have contended in that NL Central. Bottom line is the Padres get a top-notch pitcher. They give up nothing but Zach Davies. And when you look at what the Rays got in return for Blake Snell from San Diego, there was a lot. There was a Louis Patino. He's number three in San Diego's farm system. They got Cole Wilcox. Here's another right-hander with a wild arm. Francisco Mejia. He was once a top prospect, right? So when you look at what San Diego gave up to get Snell, and you look at what they gave up to give you Darvish, you have to be sick as a Chicago Cubs fan, because I do believe that Hoyer isn't necessarily tearing it down, but it's going to be a long rebuild process if he's not.
Well, I mean, this is a case of a general manager who wants to placate the fan base, because it is a tear-down move. And there's no shame, and this is what I don't get, right? There's no shame in saying, look, we have to, quote, reevaluate. We have to do this. We have to do that, right? And it's fine when you're doing that and you're a team that doesn't have a lot of expectations. If you're a Colorado Rockies, you're always reevaluating. You're always looking at ways to get better, ways to cut costs, ways to get this guy, that guy. If you're a Cubs, though, you're a legacy team. You don't rebuild. You reload, right? All that crap. But that's what the Cubs are doing. They are rebuilding. There's no shame in that. And the fact that the general manager doesn't want to use that terminology, doesn't want to throw in the teardown thing. Yes, it's a teardown. Yes, we're rebuilding. Yes, we're no longer the top dog in Chicago anymore. The White Sox are. You're going to have to deal with that for a couple of years. Cubs fans, if anything, from the long-term perspective of things, they should be used to this. Like, how is it all of a sudden they win one World Series in the last 10 years, and all of a sudden now they're the juggernaut of the National League? I don't get that. Like, you should be used to being second rate. You should be used to being in this position where you're constantly second-guessing yourself. The new general manager coming in there and making a move like this, yes, this is a rebuild. This is what it looks like. You're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, you know why this is a rebuild? I think it's a clear indication. When Theo Epstein walked away from Chicago, in my mind, that tells me that it was a clear rebuild. Theo is very strategical in what he has done over the course of his baseball career. He walked away from the Red Sox a year before a teardown. And this tells me that Tom Ricketts, the owner, had made it abundantly clear that it was time for a teardown. Theo's baseball reputation is too clean for him to be involved in a teardown. He joins teams that are dumpster fires, teams that have a project, and he builds them up. He doesn't tear them down, right? So when Theo decided to walk away, that told me right then and there that, A, Tom Ricketts either wanted control or he was going to institute a teardown, insert Jed Hoyer. That's what that told me.
That's all it is. And if you want to know what it's going to look like for your Cubs fan in 21, take a look at what the Red Sox did the year after Theo Epstein left the Red Sox. What did they do? They made monumental moves. They dumped money. They got rid of talent, and they rebuilt. And that's what this is going to be. That's what this, now whether it's a year, 2 years, 3 years, or a dozen years, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, because that's exactly what this is right now, and it's just going to be up to the new general manager and the new team, you know, the new lineup, the new roster, to develop themselves. And if they can, they can. They can't, they can't. But to call this anything but a teardown or a rebuild is being monumentally optimistic and monumentally stupid.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening in Chicago. And like I said, when you look at everything that has happened in that division, it's kind of an odd time. Because there's no reason why the Chicago Cubs could not compete in what is a very underwhelming division in baseball right now. You have to look at what the Padres are doing and what the Cubs are doing, and you have to applaud the Padres. Is it enough to put them over the hump in 2021? I don't believe so, but there's plenty of other moves to take place, and there are other moves that are really going to give us a clearer picture in the National League. For instance, the rumors of the Dodgers talking with DJ LeMahieu. Trevor Bauer has been persistent and always bringing up the Dodgers subtly. Right, without just coming out and saying, I want to play for the Dodgers, he's brought this up. And it is a very attractive...
I don't even know how subtle it is. He's got an ad on Facebook.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's where he wants to be. I mean, it's obvious. And
he's got an ad on Facebook photoshopped of him in a Dodger uniform pitching at Dodger Stadium. That's not subtle.
Well, he did put it... In all fairness, he did put a picture of himself in an Angels hat on Twitter a couple of months ago, and I don't know why anyone would want to go join that train wreck, but he did do that. So he's just a different character. But until these dominoes fall of potential players possibly going to the National League, and this goes well beyond the Dodgers, right? It would not shock me if Trevor Bauer was to sign a one-year deal with a contending team in the National League to put them into the category the tier of World Series contenders. For instance, Steve, we haven't even talked about the idea that the Atlanta Braves added Charlie Morton on a one-year deal. Like, that's a monumental move, right? So while the Padres are flashy right now and they've made moves, and it's no discredit to them, Atlanta has gotten better under the radar. And the Dodgers could get much better in the next 72 hours or so in a blockbuster-type way.
Look, I mean, it's gone from Arenado now apparently over to LeMahieu. And look, I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions on Padres fans over here, but you can add eight pitchers to that rotation as far as I'm concerned. Good luck with that lineup if the Dodgers add LeMahieu. Good luck, because that lineup, you and I were talking about it off the air, the potential lineup of a 1-2-3 batter, a 1-2-3 starting lineup of Mookie Betts, DJ LeMahieu, and Justin Turner in batting third. And then we haven't even mentioned Bellinger. We haven't mentioned the rest of that lineup. We haven't mentioned Corey Seager in that lineup. We haven't mentioned any of these guys. So good luck to you. Good luck to the Padres.
Yeah, the next couple of weeks of Major League Baseball are going to be absolutely fascinating. Right now, the Padres are the hot story. I could see a change in that, though, once Bauer and LeMahieu actually make the announcement of where they're going, specifically in the National League. Steve Bordstein, always a pleasure to get you on to talk Major League Baseball. I appreciate the time. Before I let you go, of course, you have to talk about where we can find more of you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Doing a lot more coverage right now on the horse racing scene. We opened up at Santa Anita the other day for their traditional opening day season. We opened up at the fairgrounds, so I'm covering horse racing now over at horseracingnation.com. Also doing some great work with the folks up at Four Corners Broadcasting. So you can follow me and get more of my more stuff from me over on Twitter at Radio Durango SB.
Steve, always a pleasure. I know we'll talk again relatively soon as more news trickles out in Major League Baseball. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Happy New Year again.
We'll take one more quick commercial break and return to wrap up this edition of Drive Time Sports right after this on 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
Hey, what's going on? This is Ron Artest, and you're listening to Drive Time Sports with Jordan. Listen, you must... Say it again. Buscarini? All right. Jordan Buscarini. All right. With Jordan Buscarini. Shout out to Queensbridge, you already know.
Coming to you live from Price.
Put that cookie down!
Price, Utah.
Now!
Me and my man, Trav. Love Price. Price is awesome.
Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini and Travis Anderson on KOAL AM 750. Eastern Utah's main source for local sporting news.
That's the name of the game. out of time on this edition of Drive Time Sports. We'll be back to do it again tomorrow. In fact, we'll be back with you tonight. Myself alongside Travis Anderson. On our way out right now, we'll catch up with you at Manti High School as the Emory Spartan boys basketball team is on the road to take on the Templars. Always fun when those two teams get together. Don't forget, you can also listen live at CastleCountryRadio.com, and live pregame coverage will begin at 6:30 p.m. For Travis Anderson, I'm Jordan Buscarini, thanking Antoine Staley and Steve Bordstein for taking out the time to join us. I'll catch you tomorrow. Be safe. I am out.